from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
1950 San Francisco, certainly we'll make things come.
Coming up next on Forum, San Francisco's Palace of Fine Arts, designed by Bernard Maybeck, may be the best-known remnant of the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition. But the impact and legacy of the exposition goes far beyond that monumental structure. The fair, which attracted some 20 million visitors, commemorated the completion of the Panama Canal and marked the city's triumphant recovery from the 1906 earthquake. Pavilions spotlighted new technologies like the automobile, air travel, and the first-ever transcontinental phone call. 100 years later, we discuss the fair's lasting significance. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And in this hour, we celebrate the 100-year anniversary and bring to light the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition by bringing to your attention the event, which covered some 635 acres of San Francisco, with the building of a city within the city located in what is now the Marina District. There was never anything like the exposition, which attracted nearly 19 million people, and it was deemed a grand success, originally and officially heralded as a celebration of the completion of the Panama Canal, as well as the 400th year anniversary of the discovery by Balboa of the Pacific Ocean. It also dramatically highlighted at that time the recovery of San Francisco from the 1906 earthquake and fire that had devastated the city. There were pavilions at the exposition representing 28 states and 21 countries, exhibitions of new technologies, and even bringing in of the Liberty Bell from Philadelphia. In 9 months' time, all of the buildings, which were made out of a non-lasting material, were gone, although remnants, including the San Francisco Palace of Fine Arts, remain. And in this forum hour, I want to spotlight and turn our attention to the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition. We have a number of esteemed historians here with us and authors in studio, and let me introduce them to you. Anthea Hartig is Executive Director of the California Historical Society, and their exhibit, City Rising, San Francisco in the 1915 World's Fair, opens this weekend at the Palace of Fine Arts and the Society's headquarters on Mission Street. For more information, just go to kqed.org/forum, and welcome Anthea Hartig.
Welcome to you. It's great to be back.
Glad to have you here with us again. And Laura Ackley is also with us in studio, and she's architectural historian and author of a new book called San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. Welcome, Laura Ackley.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Lee Bruno, who's here with us as well, journalist and author. His book is called Panorama, Tales from San Francisco's 1915 Pan-Pacific International Exposition, and his great-grandfather, Reuben Hale, first proposed the 1915 Hale. Welcome, Lee Bruno.
Good morning. Thanks, Michael. I'm a big fan of your show, so thanks for being here.
Nice of you to say, and glad to have you here. Glad to have all of you here. And let's begin, Anthea, with you, if we may. And let's begin just by talking about, before we get into the exposition, the campaign. There was a big battle between San Francisco and New Orleans. Some of it got pretty ugly. And there was a postcard campaign, something like of which we will never see again, no doubt. But give us that background in terms of how San Francisco won the Congress over and got this massive and enormous and extraordinary exposition.
Sure, Michael. Well, I tend to think of it increasingly as a moment where San Francisco had come together before the great earthquake and fire, as we can learn more from Lee and his family heritage, to really kind of post itself and position itself as the city that would connect the East and the West. So a 1904 idea became really for many people a moral imperative after the great devastation of 1906. And they were completely undaunted in their zeal. And this combined city leadership, city business leaders, men, women who reached across not only gender lines, but I think ethnic and religious lines, surely, and even class lines, to really position San Francisco as the city. Of course, it didn't hurt that they raised almost all of the money themselves, chipped in by the state. So by the time they got to Congress, and you can imagine at Congress, William Randolph Hearst testifying in front of Congress with D. Young at his side. They must have been a formidable set of men led by Charles Moore, the president of the Exposition Board. And I think they really carried the day in Congress with both the passion that they brought, the money that they brought, the fact that San Diego had gracefully bowed out of the running, would hold its own exposition that same year in a very different but equally as interesting way. So I think it marked for San Franciscans by the time they broke ground in 1911 that they could do this. And they, of course, proceeded with great earnest.
And brought about something that really was quite extraordinary for the time. And even looking back, I mean, we're talking about from Crissy Field to Fort Mason. We're talking about something that was not only local but global. And you've compared it to, I mean, in terms of knowledge and trying to bring all this knowledge into this city within a city, to Google or the World Wide Web.
Well, thanks for reminding me. I've tried to figure out how to get my arms around this as a historian, and as we've been working all with colleagues and our curators and our exhibition team on presenting the fair and working so closely with a lot of great scholars like Laura and Lee. So I'm thinking of it as the three-dimensional World Wide Web of 1915, because there was nowhere to go to physically experience all of the latest innovation, all of the latest industry, to taste, to see, to smell, and then, of course, to experience this very complicated and beautiful set of cityscapes, of landscapes, of colors. I mean, the depth to which the architectural team, the designers, and the colorists went to create a very inclusive and rich environment certainly exceeded anything like an encyclopedia, which would have been your go-to if you had access probably to a library. You could have looked up things in an encyclopedia. But this, to me, is a visual three-dimensional version of kind of World Wide Web. And that's why people, of course, came in droves and spent days and days. You know, one of the most beautiful stories is Ansel Adams. His parents took him out of school, gave him a year-long pass and a camera.
And there were some big names there. I mean, for the time, Thomas Edison and John Philip Sousa, Wild Bill Cody, the list goes on, Charlie Chaplin, Luther Burbank. But Lee Bruno, your great-grandfather was wondering, is anybody going to even come? If we have a fair, will anyone show?
Well, I think a little thing called World War I.
I think that the earthquake was one huge obstacle to overcome, and it was there was a reconstruction dinner that was in July of 1906. And when I read this speech that he gave at the St. Francis Hotel to not only the directors but to other civic leaders, he reestablished the vision that we should not forget about this earthquake. Half the city is living in tents. The city's in ruins. And so there was something about the vision that was very much going to leverage and also synergize with the reconstruction of the city. And I think that part happens. And then, of course, this other big challenge of August 1914, the Panama Canal opens and World War I breaks out. So there was a letter writing campaign that was quite phenomenal. 2 million letters were sent from California. The directors basically had realized that they needed to get the word out to all the Easterners and to people throughout the United States that the fair would go on. And a letter writing campaign was organized. So basically, people in California were asked to write three letters to friends in the East and encourage them to come to the fair, that the fair was going to go on. Don't give up hope. Those three people were then supposed to send another three letters. So we create this massive letter chain. 2 million postcards are sent that in that month, and this is September of 1914. And then
they didn't include any of these things like if you don't send this on, you'll have bad luck, like the chain letters
right. For 13 years.
No, it's just it's wonderful about these events too for us to be celebrating this 100 year because postcards, memorabilia comes out of the woodwork, and people's families that actually did come here get a chance to celebrate and also reconnect with their history and their families.
And she also had thousands, literally thousands of laborers and architects who were involved in this exposition. Yeah?
Yeah, it was. And I think the labor story is quite interesting. I mean, San Francisco was a closed shop, and labor historians know really well that there was a lot of strife, and this was the only fair that did not have a strike during the fair. That's really unusual because, you know, we're talking about fairs that have been going on across America over the years, and there were labor stoppages. So that's another, you know, and that was really brought about because of the leadership of P.H. McCarthy, who was one of the previous mayors, and also the labor councils. But that's a very important underlying story of getting the fair done.
And there was a St. Louis exposition, which I suppose to some extent was a model at that time, but there really was nothing like this. And Laura Ackley, I want to get a sense from you of actually what people saw when they visited this. I guess the real centerpiece was the Tower of Jewels. That was the most, at least, well-recognized building. It had hundreds of thousands of colored glass jewels.
Yes. When the visitor pushed their way through the turnstiles, they would step from an area of San Francisco that was particularly disorganized. As a matter of fact, it was sometimes called Dump Town because people would dump their unwanted buildings there. And so they would come from this rather chaotic portion of the city, and they'd go through the turnstiles and under the great arches, and they'd find themselves in this incredible wide expanse of gardens and fountains and pools facing a 435-foot-tall stepped tower. So that's a 43-story-tall building. You can even imagine what dropping a 43-story-tall building in the marina would look like today. And at the time, I believe the second tallest building in San Francisco was 11 stories, and it was in the financial district. So this was this immense structure that stepped back in tiers and was indeed hung with 102,000 cut glass gems that were specially faceted and each backed by a mirror that increased its brilliance in a variety of kind of candy colors, and each was hung by a hook so that they were allowed to move in the breezes. They were not static, and thus the building sparkled and glinted in the breezes day and night.
Well, there's so much to talk about that was at this exposition. I hope we can really do justice, but it's important, I suppose, for people who know little about it or nothing about it at all, to realize there were all these palaces and courts and state and foreign buildings. Most of them were made out of this plastic-like material that didn't last. And as a result, this was pretty ephemeral. 9 months, one gestation, right?
Well, this was by design, actually, and all the previous World's Fairs had conformed to this sort of precedent. World's Fairs were historically always meant to be ephemeral, and they were always made out of these ephemeral materials. The things that survived, like the Chicago's Field Museum, which is a legacy of the 1893 World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition held in Chicago, are rarities, and of course our own Palace of Fine Arts.
That is one of the few lasting things from the exposition, our own Palace of Fine Arts, correct?
That is true, although you can find fragments all over the Bay Area and even to some degree across the country, because basically before the fair even ended, the Department of Buildings and Grounds started taking offers for virtually everything at the fair, right down to a potted azalea and all the way up to entire buildings. So some buildings were floated down the bay or across the bay, and various statues were moved to a variety of locations. But you could buy a window or piping or a single tree. And so in a way, it almost went back to the earth. It diffused itself.
Well, we also have Bill Graham Civic Auditorium and the Japanese Tea House, right? I mean, those are
There's a bridge. The Japanese Tea House is actually primarily from the 1894 Midwinter Fair.
Is it the bridge that's there?
There is a bridge from the PPIE. However, part of the Japanese Pavilion is now the Vans restaurant in Belmont. And there are various other small buildings that are still located around the bay. There's an exciting new project being published by California Historical Society called After the Lights Went Out, which was spearheaded by a wonderful PPIE historian named Glenn Koch. And that traces the location of some of the things that still remain in the Bay Area from the
PPIE, fair. By the way, again, is the Panama Pacific International Exposition. We're still talking about it 100 years later, and this is, in fact, the centennial year of the exposition. I wanted to actually give listeners an idea of the other sorts of things that could be seen and what was going on there. I mean, it was the first transcontinental telephone call. I think we have actually a can you set this up for us, Laura? This is Thomas Edison, no less, yeah? We don't have a clip. It just maybe... Dan is saying, can you explain it to us?
Well, the transcontinental telephone call is an outstanding example of the types of new technology that corporations would bring to world's fairs. It actually, the very first kind of public call actually took place about a month before the fair started in January of 1915. We just had its centennial where they had a ceremony at the California Historical Society to commemorate it. And in New York was Alexander Graham Bell, the originator of the telephone. And in San Francisco at the telephone company office was Thomas Watson, who's received his first transmission about 38 years before. So now, instead of being just a few miles apart, they were 3,400 miles apart. And the text of their call is just the finest marketing speak ever created. Mm-hmm. Where they praised the great work of the telephone men.
Well, there were also, I mean, it's hard to think of this as new technology, telephones. I still remember party lines, but are there any home telephones anymore? Does everybody have a cell phone? I guess there's still some home telephones, but they also had competition to decide who had the best typewriter between Remington and Westinghouse. They were typing in different languages at keyboards, about 136, I think, the count that I saw. This is at a time when, if I remember from writers like Theodore Dreiser, where women who were secretaries were actually called typewriters. You know, it was ushering in a whole new era of technology. And when we talk about Huntington with the first steam locomotive from the Southern Pacific Railroad, when we talk about the fact that there was an actual Parthenon made out of redwoods, it's just staggering to think about all that was there for people to see and to experience. You had Blackfoot Indians at a Glacier National Park exhibit. You had a replica of Old Faithful in Yellowstone Inn, and on it goes. I mean, just to try to capture it. And thank heavens we have these books and we have this exhibit now. Again, I'll give it another plug, City Rising, San Francisco and the 1915 World's Fair, which is opening this weekend at the Palace of Fine Arts and the Society's headquarters on Mission Street. But you can also go to our website and see actually photographs of some of the things we're talking about here and some of the things that were going on, kqed.org/forum. We actually had the Liberty Bell from Philadelphia, Smithsonian exhibit. It goes on and on, and it's really remarkable that so much of this is really being revived now, 100 years later in the centennial. Let's talk also with you, if we could, Laura Ackley, about the air shows. In fact, there was actually, was it Lincoln Beachey who crashed and ultimately?
Yeah, Lincoln Beachey was one of the most famous early stunt aviators, and he was a local boy. I believe he was a native San Franciscan. And the Panama Pacific Exposition was the first World's Fair at which aviation was a feature because the Wright brothers' first successful test flight was in December 1903. So the next World's Fair, 1904, it really was not possible. And so 1915 was the next big World's Fair. So this was really the birth of aviation, and they decided to have stunt flyers at the fair. Lincoln Beachey actually became the world's first indoor aviator when he flew a plane through the unfinished Palace of Machinery about a year before the fair was completed. He was featured on opening day.
That was the largest structure in the world, I think, the Palace of Machinery.
It was the largest wood frame building in the world, yeah. Certainly 9 acres under roof. It was nearly 1,000 feet long. Anyway, so Beachy was featured on opening day. I believe he released doves from his airplane. And he was really a big deal locally. And he was trying a new monoplane. He'd been flying biplanes previously. And he was trying a new monoplane in March, March 14th. And flying upside down, but his elevation was not sufficient to come out of the upside down flight, and it sheared the wings off his plane, and he fell into the bay. People believe that he was not killed by the fall, but rather because he was strapped into the plane and he drowned.
Laura Ackley, again, is architectural historian and author of the new book, San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. And Thea Hartig is executive director of the California Historical Society. And just historically for a minute, let's get our bearings here, Aunt Thea. Sure. There were a lot of people who were displaced. I mean, there have been analogies to what happened then and the gentrification we're going through now.
Well, I think one of the really interesting challenges and opportunities that we have with 2015 is looking, of course, back to 1915 and then ahead to 2115 and what will the world hold? What will San Francisco be? And certainly the parallels and the ironies and the complications of for whom would the city exist? How would it look? Where would people live? We're all in intense conversations and discourses in the years leading up to the fair. And as we've talked about, the power of displacement and the horrors of 1906 were still in evidence as the fair was being developed. And the last refugee camp, I think there ended up being over 400 cottages moved, probably most of them moved, was in the site chosen in the end for the World's Fair. It was a site that was swampy. It had been an Ohlone trading village. It was a really wonderful spot in the bay where the bay dipped down naturally. And it had been kind of the last place where people could go really for affordable housing. And it was both the kind of progressive zeal that declared that those little earthquake cottages might not be safe and sanitary, and then the real push to clear that land, to start filling it, to craft the baseline infrastructure, to lay all of the new sewage and water systems for the fair, that really between 1911 and 1912 finally kind of cleared that land. So we think, you know, can you imagine filling that much of the bay now and displacing all those people? But as you know, if you've seen, everyone's seen the plans for the bay well into the 1960s, that really called for the utter transformation of the shoreline. And in 1915, you know, very, very different prevailing notions.
We're going into the break here with a song, 1915 San Francisco, by Henry Burr and Albert Campbell. Join us if you have questions or comments about the 1915 exhibition, which we are talking about, the exposition 100 years later. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. For more coverage of the Panama Pacific International Exposition Anniversary, tune into KQED Newsroom on Friday at 8 p.m. on KQED Television 9. Tomorrow on Forum, my guest will be David Axelrod, former campaign strategist and senior advisor to President Barack Obama. He'll join us in the studio to talk about his new memoir, Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. To listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast, visit kqed.org/forum. And for the latest updates on our shows and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition, and there's a lot that's going on around the anniversary, which we'll tell you about as we move along in this hour. In the meantime, let me just say that new technology and dazzling displays and new agricultural advances, this was really almost, a first premier kind of a first-rate and premier kind of event, the likes of which the world had never seen, right here in San Francisco. And there was so much going on. There were, as we said earlier, people there of great fame at the time, people like Henry Ford and Charlie Chaplin, Thomas Edison, not to mention Buffalo Bob was howdy doody, and Luther Burbank, and also interested in finding out what your thoughts are. You can go on our website, by the way, and look at some of the photographs and give us your reaction to those, kqed.org/forum. But in the meantime, we welcome your questions and comments, and you can join us a number of ways. You can call in. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Lee Bruno, again, is journalist and author of Panorama, Tales from San Francisco, 1915 Pan-Pacific International Exposition. And as we said earlier, his great-grandfather, Reuben Hale, first proposed the 1915 fair. How did he get involved in this?
Well, at the time, in 1904, he was the president of the Merchant Exchange, which is pretty much what you would, the current nomenclature for that would be the Chamber of Commerce. So basically, this was a group of businessmen. He was he and his brothers ran the Hale Brothers department store on Market Street, and he was a student of history. And he I think he connected the dots and was very forward looking because in 1904, the Panama Canal came into America's hands, and really it would. He saw that that would really transform San Francisco as a port of call because you're saying it's almost 7,500 miles shorter distance. The savings would be $8,000 to $9,000 for a 1,500-ton ship, and that was in insurance and fuel and other things. And so you could start to see the economies of importance with that, and that would also be a gateway to open up new trading routes to the east. So it was very forward-looking, and I think that he shared that with others in his business community as well. But he did kind of propose that idea.
Can we talk just a bit about some of the darker side of this battle that San Francisco was waging to have the exposition here? Because there was a good deal of charges back and forth about sewers and plague and Negroes living in different areas and that sort of thing, Lee?
Well, I could jump in. Just I think 1907, I think the book by there's lots of great books that have been written about San Francisco, and History's Anteroom is a wonderful book because it talks about this rebuilding. And in 1907, you have the panic on Wall Street, but you also have bubonic plague breaking out here in San Francisco, which was a big concern. There's labor strife. There's a very all kinds of tension in the city around what happened with the Graff trials of
and Sonny Jim Rolfe was the mayor at that time.
He was right. Yes, exactly. And so it was a different era, but they're trying to shed this really ugly part of their past and with the roof and the Schmidt scandals around City Hall and Graft. So,
but it was all being used like a political campaign, right? I mean, you bring up the negative.
Yeah, very much so. And so, I think this is kind of, again, these are hurdles to overcome for not only the city, but the business community too, because people are looking from across the world and across the states, and they're saying, what's going on in San Francisco? We still get those questions now, but it was really a question of like what is happening there, and these were very big obstacles to overcome.
And Thea, how's this being celebrated? In addition to the California Historical Society having an exhibit, what else is going on to remember what happened 100 years ago here?
Well, we're launching this weekend into almost actually a little over a year's worth of celebrations with over 50 different community partners, all tucked under the umbrella of PPIE 100, so PPIE100.org, a great place to learn, in close partnership with the city, especially the mayor's office, and in particular recreation and parks, the Maybeck Foundation, you know, the stewards of the Palace of Fine Arts, and then the new tenant for this year in the Palace of Fine Arts, the Innovation Hangar. So on Saturday, this Saturday the 21st, starting at noon, you'll be roused by local taiko drummers. We're going to kick off the celebration at noon, and with dignitaries and Henry Ford III coming out from Detroit, blessed and welcomed by a Native Ohlone dance. And then the doors will be open to the palace, where children of all ages can experience both hands-on fun, a whole series of two stages, one outside the rotunda and one inside the palace. The California Historical Society, the Fine Arts Museums, music in the schools, the Exploratorium, and about 20 other partners will have booths and activities, food, all free and fun. And then that night, thanks to incredible generosity, we're going to light up the Palace of Fine Arts again as it was lit in 1915 from 7 to 10. We'll give you a sneak preview of that Friday night from 9 to 10 if you're in the neighborhood then. So it should be a really beautiful long day. We're calling it Community Day, and the whole design was to have something beautiful and free and accessible.
Sounds great, but you didn't mention what the free food is.
Let's see. You can have to buy some of the food, but some of it will be free. Tamales from Alicia's, Hungry Kong. Anyway, and the grilled cheese guy, always a perennial favorite.
Oh, yeah.
And then a wonderful set of both partners' exhibits as well as other memorabilia. So it should be really fun. Ford will have old cars and new cars there. AT&T will have old and new technology. It should be a real beautiful day. And then the next day, and our 10,000 square foot exhibition opens then. And then the next day, Innovation Hangar and CHS will be open at the Palace. And we also open, as you said, our smaller kind of jewel box exhibition. And you can see some of those Nova gems and that hung from the Tower of Jewels and the shovel that broke ground.
Photographs of the model that you had of the Panama Canal, or some of these exhibits like from Japan and China and Persia, which was then Persia, not Iran, Siamese exhibit. Well, good. I said, some of these photographs you can actually go to our website and view, kqed.org/forum, and let's find out what's on your minds. Let me go first to Sylvia. Sylvia, join us. Hi.
About the reuse of materials from the fair, maybe people don't realize that the big and beautiful Five Wounds Portuguese National Church in San Jose was built with the lumber from the Portuguese pavilion, and that lumber was brought to San Jose by oxen cart.
It's a great historical footnote. Thank you for that, Sylvia. I'm sure we'll be hearing about other remnants,
right,
because there are a lot of them around. Let me actually bring a caller in from Santa Rosa. Sue, that's you. Hi.
Hi.
Yes,
Sue. Show, and shall I turn you off? My great uncle was involved in the Sonora Tuolumne County, and he brought several huge photographs, I understand, that were framed of the county, which means that probably involved mining and cattle ranching and mountain scenes. And I wondered if there's any sign that all of the counties contributed to the exhibit, and if anybody still has them. I can't find where these are stored in Sonora, and I've looked a little bit.
Can you help us here, Laura Ackley?
Well, all 58 California counties did exhibit, and what they did is, in a departure from previous expositions, they created a single huge 5-acre California counties building that was kind of a monumental mission style. And one whole wing of it was dedicated to displays by the counties. And it was a wonderful chaos in the midst of all this beautiful kind of Beaux-Arts dreamy splendor. You'd go into this huge open space and all the counties exhibited. Now, what you're talking about, large-scale photographs glorifying a county's riches, is absolutely typical of the type of displays you'd see in the California building. However, tracing individual artifacts is well nigh impossible. So I'm sorry that I can't help you with the location of those photographs today, but I'm certain that they were there. And if one could find a photograph of the Tuolumne County, which I think may have been part of the Foothill Counties exhibit. It was a kind of a collegial exhibit of several counties together. You might be able to find a photograph showing the photographs.
And we thank you for the call, Sue.
And we might have some, too, at the California Historical Society, Sue. So you could send us a quick note at info@calhist.org, and we'll be happy to search for you.
Anybody know the story of Ansel Adams? I've got an email here. A listener named Bill says, I love the Ansel Adams story about his dad taking him out of school and buying him an annual pass to the Pan Pacific Exposition, but I believe he was given a camera in 1916 on the family's first trip to Yosemite, not in 1915, for the fair. Perhaps there's some photos by him of the fair, which I have never seen, but I think the fair and the camera were separate incidents in his life.
This is Laura. I believe that is actually true, but I found the cool thing about the Ansel Adams story, which is in his autobiography, by the way, is that Ansel Adams' birthday was February 20th, which was opening day of the fair, and he was 13 years old. And so his father bought him a season ticket book and said, if you keep up your home study of literature, language, and piano, you don't have to go to school this year. You can just go to the fair. I don't believe that he had a camera at this time, but he found out all sorts of things during this year, including he would cut through the back of the midway, the joy zone. Mm. And this was a very seamy area of the fair. And he recounts a very dramatic run-in where he actually would, he ran into someone shooting up drugs. Right. And so it really shows that the more things change, the more they stay the same.
And again, Laura Ackley is the author of San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. Lee Bruno, Dave wants to know, was the PPIE the source of palm trees that are still visible all around California?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to, the selling of various kinds of assets at the fair, those palm trees were, I think, allowed for anyone to take away if they could just carry it away. So some of the lumber was sold, but yeah, and I think palm trees are in different, still existing and probably growing in some parts of Marin, if I'm correct.
Which is slightly odd, but palms had been used in California. Of course, some palms are native to California, and then they had been imported actually earlier, starting really in the 1880s, especially down in the citrus belt in Southern California and in the desert where they grew so beautifully to line, to give a lot of grandeur to newly divided boulevards and Riverside. And yeah. So.
Can you tell us, Anthea, about the struggle to keep the Palace of Fine Arts and why more wasn't kept intact? And listener wants to know, how was it saved?
Right. That's a wonderful question. So thank you, unknown listener. And the
Stav is the listener.
Stan.
He's not unknown. His name is Stav. I'm sorry.
Oh, Stav. Yeah. Okay, dear Stav. The role of women in the fair, led by Phoebe Hearst, Mrs. Frederick Sanborn, a very prominent woman of San Francisco, really can't be underestimated. They not only ran the vast California building, they worked in any number of the different pavilions and were involved in exhibitions. But long before the fair, they had been advocating to have the fair in San Francisco. And then in particular, alongside kind of the archaeology of the promotion of the fair is that the 2 million postcards and then Phoebe Hearst entertaining foreign dignitaries at her homes in Wintoon and in Pleasanton, making sure she was kind of like the diplomat in charge, if you will, of the making sure that the national pavilions would remain. And she took it very much to heart. So it's not surprising that she and others would lead the preservation campaign of the palace and started conversations before the fair ended, and then really intensified in 1916. I think for her and for so many others to see that much art amassed in one place, to see the potential of San Francisco as a cultural capital of the American West was a true challenge and something that they rose to with vigor and with dollars. And then she also, I think, convinced or shamed any number of the original investors, and you had shares in the fair. So to turn those shares, instead of turning them in perhaps for money, to turn them in to help save the palace. So the first real effort to save it, to save Bernard Maybeck's melancholy masterpiece, was very successful.
Thanks to Phoebe Appleton Hearst.
And many others. But the power of Mrs. Hearst was undeniable. And she really truly believed that San Francisco deserved to have that beauty stay. And then it would be both completely rebuilt along Maybeck's plans in 1965 as the whole city is changing, wrenching changes again socially and culturally, and a real interesting moment for historic preservation activists to recreate part of 1915, and then again in 2010.
So. Let me go to some more of your emails. Mary Lee writes, many civic organizations were founded prior to and because of the upcoming Panama Pacific International mm-hmm. Exposition, mm-hmm. and many of them are still going strong. San Francisco Symphony, the Book Club of California, mm-hmm. California Society of Printmakers. The letter is open to printmakers worldwide. Mm-hmm. Another listener writes, my great-grandfather, Charles Green, lined up the funding mm-hmm. for the fair. I still have some furniture from the Chinese Pavilion. My family might be interested in donating it to a museum. Is there such a place? I can't wait to see the opening.
Great. Very cool.
Anybody want to suggest where he could, this is Mike, where he could take that furniture?
Well, I think my house has a lovely a place that I'll hold on to it till that permanent museum.
And you'll claim a nonprofit for your mortgage, too.
There you go. But, you know, I believe that many of us hope that with so many wonderful artifacts mm-hmm. still in the Bay Area, that eventually we are able to mount a permanent museum. Could be a small museum, but really dedicated to just this fair because it was such a important moment in the history of San Francisco.
Right. For now, you could certainly talk to the Oakley Museum of California, who has mm-hmm. a larger three-dimensional collection. Mm-hmm. We'd be happy to talk to them as well. Our collection is more research geared. But
well, could we say Anthea can get in touch with you?
Of course he can.
Again, Anthea Hartig is executive director of the California Historical Society. Here's Rob, who writes, large, beautiful, framed, and labeled photos of the 1915 Pan-Pacific International Exposition are on display and available for public viewing on the 15th through 19th floors of the Philip Burton Federal Building at 450 Golden Gate Avenue.
Wonderful.
Oh, I didn't know that. How fabulous. Awesome.
And a tweet from the from the San Francisco Ballet. They tweet us that the exposition is an inspiration for our uniquely San Francisco Nutcracker. Sean writes,
yes, absolutely.
Please ask your guests to discuss the painting, sculpture, craft, and design in the expo. Which American artists were represented, and how did the expo influence the arts and crafts movement in the Bay Area?
Well, that's a
big question.
That's a big question, and I'll tell you why it's a big question.
It's Laura Ackley.
That is oftentimes the fine arts show. That is the art that was shown within the Palace of Fine Arts, which was a real art gallery, was over 11,000 works of art. And it hasn't received a whole lot of respect over the years because I believe it was so huge and so diffuse. And it came just 2 years after the Armory Show, which was very focused on the latest in modern art, but it was only, while still huge, it was only 3,000 pieces of art. And so my thesis on the art show is that you could see very focused, incredible selections of and collections of art. You could see the best in Impressionism or the Ashcan School or Hudson River School, but you'd kind of have to go and self-curate. And the art exhibit was a huge deal that year. There were a number of docents that gave classes all year, and it was very fashionable among society women to go and learn about the art and talk about the art.
Still is.
And
still is.
I'm very, very excited that the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco are mounting an exhibit later this year, opening in October, of
October 17th.
About 250 of the pieces of art that were actually shown at the fair.
Amanda just brought in this email from Carrie, a bit of trivia. Carrie writes, "My great-great-grandfather, Peter Louis Schwert, was killed at the fair by runaway horses." Wow, we're going back even a generation before you, Lee.
Well, you know, but that's, I think that's important because we forget, like, how much of California and the rest of the country was just agrarian society. And I think that also points out that Luther Burbank was so popular and such a, you know, such a rock star when he came here. He was, you know, because it was a different time. And you know, the other just footnote is that this is really the last fair of its kind. I mean, there, this was grand in scale, but the fairs were sort of diminishing. So this was the last hoopla, and I think it's an important kind of, you know, final signature note and exclamation point for San Francisco as well.
Right. Well, in fact, I'm looking at an email here from a listener who says, "Wow, that tower sounds pretty amazing." And then he goes on to say, "Today we have the Olympics and the World Cup as global spectacles. Is there any life in the World's Fair tradition as far as plans for future events?" Oh, no, at this point.
Yes, yes. You can go to Milan this year for the 2015 World's
Fair. That will be the next World's Fair, but that's scaled down from what we're talking about at this
exhibition.
Actually,
they can be some of the more recent World's Fairs have had more attendees than any previous World's Fair, but I think your listener is touching upon is very, very critical. And all of us here on the panel would agree that it just no longer hold the same cultural import because we have so many other ways of receiving information and data. And at the time of the Panama Pacifica International Exposition, one of the goals literally stated was that if the rest of the world were destroyed, they could pretty much recreate it from everything that was within the 635 acres.
Catherine writes, "Thank you for the guests today. There is great family and cultural pride for my brother and I since our family came from Sicily to San Francisco after the great quake. They formed the Minatoli Grassi Marble and Granite Company that helped rebuild the city, the 1915 event, and more. People can find their work at the Academy of Science in Golden Gate Park with those pressed granite seal statues and the bears, and the huge orca fountain that they created was moved from the exhibition to Steinhardt Aquarium to its current home at the University of the Pacific. The innovation from them was the pressed granite process, which we now enjoy as countertops and more."
That's great.
More of your calls, too. Mary joins us. Mary, welcome.
Hi. I'm calling in. I've got Julia Morgan's sketchbook from the fair, the exposition. And it's got numerous sketches of the Japanese village. I've got Norway, Sweden, France, Denmark, North Dakota, and Indiana, horticultural gardens from the Holland exhibit. I've got sketches of furniture from the GE pavilion that show a shaving mirror with an electric bottle warmer. I've got all sorts of wonderful things. The home of redwood.
My.
And all our drawings have the measurements, all the details of the most incredible little parts of that fair.
Oh, you've got something really priceless there. Was Julia Morgan at the fair?
she was at the fair to sketch it.
Yeah.
Because all these, she's got them dated and, you know, where she was. And
yeah, she was already working for Maybach.
Because I see these lists of all the VIPs and I never saw
She actually had some designs at the fair but was not yet a major architect. However, she had a long association with the YWCA. And she designed the interior of the YWCA pavilion at the fair. And then it is said that she designed the girls' clubhouse on the zone, which was a little building underneath the roller coaster where the female performers, who often basically bunked in these little rooms above and behind the attractions, could go and have a hot shower or a hot meal or simply sit and read. I would dearly love to see that sketchbook, and Thea and Lee and I are all
Their mouths are watering here, Mary.
We're trying to contain ourselves, Julie.
So yeah, if we can arrange that, that would be absolutely wonderful.
Can I suggest maybe again that Aunt Thea be the contact person here?
Sure.
Because she's the easiest one to get
absolutely
a hold of over at the California Historical Society. And Mary, I thank you for that call.
She had such a fine hand, Julie Morgan's drawing. She was obviously the first woman architect trained at the L'École de Beaux-Arts, so I think it would be lovely.
Also a ukulele.
Right, and you can at 3 p.m. on Saturday, you too can bring your ukulele. We're having what we think is will be one of the largest yukathons in the outside rotunda. Ben On, Hannah Ho, Hiram Kailula Bell, the Academy of Hawaiian Arts, and more special guests will be all playing the ukulele. There'll be lessons for the ukulele, dancing, all kinds of fun under the rotunda.
Yeah, I just got to get Arthur Godfrey out of my head here, dating myself there. But why the ukulele? The ukulele played a prominent role in this exhibition, didn't it?
It did. I think the role of the Pacific world in the World's Fair is undeniable and very powerful. And we're still obviously learning about wrestling with California and San Francisco's position as certainly west of the east coast of California, but very much east of Asia. Mm-hmm. And so much of the music, the culture, the native traditions, and were on full display. Some, more difficult to swallow for our modern minds than others. But the beautiful music from Hawaii that took a Portuguese invention, the ukulele, and really made it their own, came to the fair and was the, Laura writes about this beautifully, was the place to go. I mean, thousands of people a day would cram into this pretty small, I think relatively small stage to hear a beautiful Hawaiian quartet, no? Was it a quartet?
Wish we had more time here. We're coming to the end of the hour.
Oh, no.
Because we're getting, I know it goes too fast. But
I know, it should be 2 hours.
A lot of people calling in with memories of their grandparents and mementos and remnants and all that sort of thing. But
we'll have a great way for them to share all of that on ppa100.org through our History Print project. So I would encourage people to
Let me plug again City Rising, San Francisco, and the 1915 World's Fair, opening this weekend, Palace of Fine Arts and the Society's headquarters on Mission Street. For more information, go to kqed.org/forum, and you can go to that website and see some of the things that were so marvelously on display at this exhibition. Thanks to Anthea Hartig from the California Historical Society. Thanks to Lee Bruno. His book is Panorama, Tales from the San Francisco 1915 Pan-Pacific International Exposition. And thanks to Laura Ackley, architectural historian. Her book, San Francisco's Jewel City. And thank you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.